Well, I want to begin with the chart, the Genesis chart, just to remind you how we look through this book of Genesis. There's four key events in the first 11 chapters. We looked at those last week in the creation, the fall, the flood, and Babel. Then there are four key individuals that take up the rest of the book of Genesis, beginning with Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. We looked at Abraham last Sunday night and a little bit on Wednesday night for those of you that could make it. And then today we are going to look at Isaac and Jacob this morning and finish up with the story of Joseph this evening. So this morning we're looking at Isaac and Jacob. As we open the 25th chapter of Genesis, we have already been introduced to our second key individual, Isaac. He was a miracle child given to Abraham and Sarah. He is the son of the special covenant promise and the terrified victim disciple who was laid upon an altar when his father prepared to kill him. He was a shocked observer when God intervened and spared his life. He has now learned that he has been a privileged individual through whom God's covenant promise will be fulfilled. But as we turn our focus upon this young married man this morning, we find that he has some troubling matters in life with which to deal, even before the covenant issues are going to take center stage. His father Abraham, for example, complicates the process by getting remarried and having more children. Of course, there's nothing wrong with him doing that at first. Children are wonderful blessings from the Lord, but two issues develop in the course of time. First, these children all start families who eventually become tribes and nations who develop into enemies of the covenant people Israel. Second, when these children reach adulthood, in verses 5 and 6 of chapter 25, Abraham forces them all to leave the homestead with no inheritance whatsoever. He does give each of them a gift, it says, but he gave the entire inheritance to Isaac and sent all the rest of them away. You can imagine how that created jealousies and bitterness. No wonder they became enemies. Then Isaac had to care for his father up to his death and burial. A powerful but key phrase is employed by God in describing Abraham's death in verse 8. Can you see it there at the end? He was gathered to his people. He was gathered to his people. In death, he did not cease to exist. He simply joined family members who had died before him. Think of those family members that had died before him: Sarah, Shem, Methuselah, Enoch, Noah, and others. How wonderful to describe death in such a meaningful way. Death is not the end, folks. It is a continuing existence with your people. He was gathered to his people. It is fascinating that the next section we'll see in a moment, verses 12 through 18, which gives a brief genealogical record of Isaac's half-brother, Ishmael, also employs the same phrase to describe his death. He was gathered to his people. Even while the same phrase is used, the sense seems to be that they ended up in two very different places in death. Nevertheless, both indicate clearly that there is a continuing existence after death. So let's look at these chapters that deal with the life of Isaac. We're going to look at Isaac in three different phases of his life. The first is the early life challenges that we find in chapter 25. I'm going to move through these quickly, so some of you have got notes. If you didn't get notes, there you can just go back and somebody will, we got one of the ushers back there that will give you the notes there. Father's remarriage is the first one. You saw that in verses 1 through 6. That's a challenge. That's a challenge. When father gets remarried, he has five more sons, and that created 17 different nations. One by Hagar, two by Isaac, and 12 by Ishmael. If you want notes, put your hand up. Here comes Keith. He'll give them to you there, and you can have those for you. Genesis 17:4 told us that thou shalt be a father of many nations. God's word came true. There were at least 17 different nations that were fathered by Abraham. But these nations all become troubling neighbors to the covenant family, the covenant people. Isaac had to deal with these blended family issues at the beginning. So the first issue that Isaac has to deal with in his early life is this blended family from the father's remarriage. The second is his father's death. Verses 7 through 11, Abraham is 175 years old. Taking care of parents in old age can be a challenge. I went through that issue for the last 10 years. We buried my father, then my mother, just a couple of years ago. And so it can be a challenge. The funeral arrangements, the burial, the estate issues, all of that is a challenge. And Isaac had that in his early life challenge as well. Thirdly is his brother's family, his father's death, then his brother's family. We get the genealogy given us in 12 through 18. Ishmael's genealogical record, it's a brief summary of Ishmael's life and his descendants. Abraham had given these boys many instructions, but the bottom line is that Isaac had to deal with his family as well in those early days. Some of you have had family issues to deal with. And so we can relate. And Isaac is no different from you and me. The next thing that he had to deal with was the infertility of his wife. His wife's infertility in verse 19, these are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begot Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah as his wife, verse 20 says, the daughter of Bethuel. Verse 21, and Isaac entreated the Lord for his wife because she was barren. It comes out in the text in an almost innocuous, matter-of-fact way, as if there was no emotional stress, no problem there. But I have known many families who've dealt with infertility through the years, and I tell you what, it is usually a very big issue and a struggle for them. A huge concern. So Isaac entreated the Lord, it says. That was a good thing to do. Most families entreat doctors and expect modern medicine to help. Isaac asked the Lord. And ultimately, it is God who can open the barren womb. We must never forget that. And so it also sounds like Isaac asked on Monday for a baby, and the Lord gave her and got her pregnant on Tuesday. That's the way it reads in the text. But judging from the slow pace of most everything else in this book, I suspect that Isaac and Rebekah prayed for many years before God opened her womb. In fact, as you do the math, as you read through here, you'll find that it did take many years. Probably at least 18 years between the time that they started asking and when God answered. 18 to 20 years before they have these babies. So that's the issue. One of the early life challenges that some families face today are very similar to the kind of things that Isaac was facing. Now notice the next thing that she faces, and that is a prophetic conflict. A prophetic conflict. Notice what happens here in verse 22. She conceived finally, and the children struggled together within her, and she said, "If it be so, why am I thus?" And she went to inquire of the Lord. This time, Rebekah is the one that does the praying. It seems that Isaac was the main one praying before. I think Rebekah was praying as well. But she is the one that does the praying, seeking answers for this unusual pregnancy. What on earth is wrong? She is walking around, and all of a sudden she feels this wrestling going on in her womb. What is going on there? And she asked the Lord, and God spoke to her and gave her the results of the ultrasound. "You are going to have twins," he told her. You knew that God had ultrasound long before we had it, didn't you? And then the shocker. God says, "By the way, these boys are going to continue to struggle and fight in your womb, but it's not just going to end there. All through life and on into the distant future, these boys are always going to be fighting each other." I'm sure Rebekah had no clue how far-reaching that prophecy would be. But I want you to look at this prophecy in verse 23. There are four key distinct prophetic statements in that verse. The first one is that there's two nations within your womb. The twins are going to become fathers of those two nations. And that's exactly what happens. We'll see in a moment. Jacob became the father of Israel. Esau became the father of the Edomites. The second one is two manner of people, it says, are in your womb. This emphasizes the radical difference that will be seen in the character and the actions and the destiny of these two nations. Thirdly, it says, one will be stronger. One of the nations will be noticeably superior in strength. And finally, the final statement is, the elder will serve the younger. Now, those four prophetic statements were the topic of some discussion, I'm telling you, in the bedroom of Isaac and Rebekah many times at night. What do you think God meant by that? What is this going to be? And perhaps even in early childhood, they remembered these prophecies and they watched these boys growing up. Which is why we know need to move on to the second one, where the final challenge that Isaac dealt with in early life is this of parental struggles. Parental struggles. And every one of you that's been parent, you know that there are struggles if you're a parent. Parents go through a number of struggles. There are three specific I want to draw your attention to in the life of Isaac here. First of all is this child development issue. Notice what's said in verse 27. It says, and the boys grew, and Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, and Jacob was a quiet man dwelling in tents. As children grow up, not only do parents notice, but others do. They notice the character development of this child, and oh, wow, that kid's got talent. That kid's smart as a whip. That kid's this or that. And they see what the child is beginning to be prone to doing. And so there's this child development, and parents struggle when they watch their children growing sometimes, and some are slower than others, and they're worried because he's not talking like he should, or she doesn't read, or she doesn't do this or that, and parents struggle with the development of their children. And every parent has a preconceived idea of what they want their child to be when they grow up. They want this child, if it's a boy, they want to be a he-man, perhaps a great athlete or something like that. Or if you're a hunter, do you want that child to be a hunter? You want them to be strong and talented and to look great. And you want your daughters to be like this. And so these parents are struggling with these developments. And Jacob doesn't like going out hunting like Esau does. And I can imagine that Isaac is worried about his son. What's wrong with you, boy? What do you want to be, a mama's boy all your life? Do you want to just cook and clean at home all the time? And there's these struggles going on in the home. Child development. Secondly, I want you to see that there's parental errors going on here. Notice what happens in verse 28. In verse 28, it says, and Isaac loved Esau because he did eat of his venison, but Rachel loved Jacob. That word but there makes the clear picture here that they're playing favorites. There is parental favoritism. Isaac loved his son Esau because he was a man of the field and he was a great hunter and he brought some good food and he loved to eat. And boy, that was just what made him one of his favorite sons. Rebekah, I'm glad that he brings meat home, but I like the way that my son learns how to cook it. And she spent time with him and she loves Jacob. You have to learn, parents, to be careful playing favorites. When my children were young, I've always loved sports. And my two boys, you know what? They come home from school when they were little and they Dad, let's go throw the football. Let's go throw the baseball. Let's go play basketball. Let's go kick the soccer ball. We played everything and every day we could do that. And I was content to let my daughters sometimes just kind of hang out with mom in the home. One day I was out mowing the yard in the front and I noticed my one daughter came out and she stood there. She was holding a basketball in her hand and she stood there watching me mow the front yard. And I said to her, Bethany, did you need something? Did you want something? And she said, I'm waiting for you. I said, waiting for what? Waiting for you to finish mow the yard so you'll play basketball with me. Now, I hadn't, I think, ever played basketball with my daughter before that day. And all of a sudden it hit me. I don't think she really necessarily wanted to play basketball. She just wanted to do something with Dad. And I tell you what, I was so ashamed of myself. I stopped mowing the lawn right at that moment and came and said, Bethany, let's go play. And I realized, you know what? I needed to spend equal time with all of my children. And you can't play favorites. And we'll find that that is one of the biggest issues here. It caused a problem in this home. Parental errors. The third thing we want to see is there's a special event that takes place. A very special event that takes place. In verse 29, it says, and Jacob loved pottage, boiled pottage, and Esau came from the field, and he was faint. He'd been hunting all day. And Esau, verse 30, said to Jacob, feed me, I pray thee, with that same red pottage, for I am faint. Therefore was his name called Edom. And Jacob said, sell me this day thy birthright. Esau said, behold, I am at the point to die. What profit shall the birthright be to me? Jacob said, swear to me this day. And he swore unto him, and he sold his birthright to Jacob. And Jacob gave Esau bread and pottage of lentils, and he did eat and drink and rose up and went his way, and he despised his birthright. You can probably all think back to a particular event in your family growing up. It might be something that all of the family talks about when you get together. A particular event that everybody in the family knows about. And it's an event that you don't forget because something happened in that event that maybe changed the way you saw each other, the way you dealt with each other. For years, this is a little one, but for years in the house that I grew up in, my older sister and I would squabble at times. And one day we were arguing and fighting over something. I don't know what it was. She was probably making cookies and I was probably dipping my finger in the batter, chocolate chip cookies. That's why I started that. And she was upset and we got struggling over something. And somehow I picked up a piece of the platter that had the butter on it. And we were still fighting and arguing, and she hit that thing, and it flipped up, and it hit the ceiling. The butter hit the ceiling. And finally it fell. But for years, there was a butter stain on that kitchen ceiling there, and it was a good high ceiling, about a 9-foot ceiling there. And every time I came home, and with my sister years after, I said, there it is, Janet, there it is. There's the butter stain. And we all remember that event. Now that's a little one, but this one was a big one because it involved something very special. And Jacob and Esau argued over it. And Jacob said, I want the birthright. You're not getting the birthright, Jake. You're the squirt. You're the runt of the family. You don't get it. I get it. All right. You're hungry, though. You want something to eat? Yeah, I want something to eat. I said, you want some food? Give me the birthright. Well, if I die, you can get it anyway, so I don't want to die. And he sells him the birthright. And that event never got forgotten for the rest of their lives. In fact, it's that event that the New Testament talks about in Hebrews. It is such a critical event that it changed a lot. But the thing I want you to notice here is that Jacob took this seriously. It may be that Rebekah was able to spend more time with Jacob and instilled in him a sense of importance regarding this covenant promise. In spite of all his issues, Jacob, there is one positive thing we could say about him. He cared deeply about the covenant promise. He may not have understood all that it entailed, but he knew somehow it was very important as it related to his relationship with God, and he wanted it. On the other hand, Esau didn't really care much about it. Now, I'm sure that they grew up learning about this birthright and learning about this covenant promise. But the Bible says right here in verse 34, at the last phrase, Esau despised his birthright. Hebrews 12, 16, and 17 gives us a commentary in this story and on the life of Esau. Esau had everything going for him. He was probably strong, dark, handsome. He was talented. He was very attractive on the outside, but he had a defective inside. His heart was corrupt. The word profane in Hebrews, what it talks about him, does not mean one who delights in profanity. What it rather describes is a person who lives life apart from God and doesn't care about God or spiritual matters. Esau's only interests were the temporal things: hunting, outdoors, eating, drinking, having a good time, the things that are for here and now. That's what profane means. I can imagine many family conversations that revolved around the divine covenant and how special it was. No doubt Esau in earlier years had at times been very interested and tender regarding this, but in the passage of time, he had begun to lose interest. Other things preoccupied his mind. He didn't need God's covenant blessing. He was doing just fine without it, thank you. The pride of his heart and the lust of the flesh had worked their tentacles into his soul and kidnapped his heart. He was beginning to make his own plans in life, and he figured he had plenty without worrying about the spiritual matters. That's the way people go today. Perhaps he figured that he could cut a temporary deal with Jacob and still get the covenant blessing later. After all, that came from Father Isaac, not from brotherly bargains. But the key in this whole story is to recognize the direction of Esau in life, which prompted his fatal decision. Hebrews 12 gives the eye-opening commentary. Esau, it tells us, had already been going the way of the world, a profane man uninterested in spiritual things. He pictures the mass of people on our world today, so wrapped up in living in this physical world with no time for a real relationship with God. Let me ask you a question this morning. Do you despise your birthright? You say, well, what birthright are you talking about? I'm talking about the right to be born again. The birthright that we get when we come into a relationship with Jesus Christ. The right to become a child of God. Do you despise that? Or do you see that as the most important aspect of the whole existence on earth? My relationship with God. Those are the early life challenges for Isaac, dealing with this whole thing. Let's quickly move on to Isaac in middle life challenges. Here's the problems he had in chapter 26. We've got the famine calamity in verses 1 through 6. There's a famine. He's got to move. Any of you that have had to move before, you know that that's a big problem. It can be a challenge. It's tough times, especially if there's a cause for moving, because you lose your job or you lose your life savings or your ability to function. There was a famine. He couldn't exist there anymore. They had to move. That was a tough time. Fraud conspiracy, verses 7 through 11. We have a deja vu all over again experience. He does the same thing as Father Abraham did. He goes down to Gerar and he lies. He says, well, that's my sister there. It's my sister, as if you're not married. And I'm her brother. He lied. He did the same thing that Abraham did. Like father, like son. Perhaps he is merely living life and dealing with whatever challenges are thrown at him at this time. We get the sense that Isaac is kind of coasting along here, not really seeking God with all of his heart, which leads then to the next one, is farming conflicts. They have this well-digging problem with neighbors, troubles. You ever have trouble with your neighbors? Can you relate to Isaac? He had some problems with his neighbors. They weren't very neighborly. God's blessing him. They're jealous, And they're fighting over land and water rights. Guess what they're still fighting over today in Israel? Land and water rights, exactly. Nothing new under the sun. Finally, there's a deal to change things. But then there's a faith check. I want you to see this in verses 23 and through 25. Notice verse 23. It says, he went up from there to Beersheba, and the Lord appeared unto him the same night and said, I am the God of Abraham, thy father. Fear not, for I am with thee and will bless thee and multiply thy seed for thy servant Abraham's sake. So God comes to him and he speaks to him and he reminds him about this covenant thing. Every once in a while, God has to come to us and remind us of our relationship. Remind us that he saved us. Remind us that we belong to him. And there's a turn in his life. Was Isaac so busy that he'd forgotten this covenant? There are times in life when the same old routine and monotony of life wears on us, and we can easily lose focus on our most important relationship with God. So this seems to be a moment of revival in Isaac's life and a recommitment for Isaac. Notice what happens in the next verse, verse 25. It says, and he builded an altar there and called upon the name of the Lord and pitched his tent there and so on. So Isaac then apparently worships God, and there's a change in his demeanor in his life. So there is this faith confirmation moment for him in which he turns to the Lord and is renewed in his faith. Finally, in his midlife, we see the final challenge of family choices. At the end of this chapter, I want you to see it with me, verse 34. And Esau was 40 years old when he took as his wife Judith, the daughter of Beri the Hittite, and Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, who were a grief of mind unto Isaac and to Rebekah. Family choices, in-law issues. Some of you struggle with all these kinds of things. You've had calamity situations come into your family. You've had fraud conspiracy moment, a time when you told a lie and got yourself in trouble for it. You've had trouble with your neighbors. You've had problems with your own faith, your own walk with God. You've gotten off track and you need to get back on. Some of you dealt with family issues with your in-laws. Isaac dealt with the same things that you and I deal with in our lives. Midlife challenges, which lead then finally to his end of life challenges or late life challenges, chapter 27. And so first of all, there's the blindness factor. And we come to chapter 27, and it came to pass when Isaac was old that his eyes were dim so that he could not see. So there's this blindness factor. It made life difficult. Aren't you glad that you can see today? Be thankful for the eyesight you've got. There is also another late life challenge, and that is the blessing fortune. The blessing of his fortune. God had blessed him. This is nothing shy of the inheritance that he's going to give to his eldest son. Isaac had amassed great wealth, and his eldest son was entitled to receive at least a double portion of that. So this was the day that he was looking forward to, getting the inheritance from dad. And so he's going to transfer that to him. So he calls Isaac to him, and he says, I'm going to have this ceremony. I want you to go out and get a deer and make a feast and come in here and we'll do this official ceremony. I'm going to give you the inheritance and the blessing. But somebody's listening around the corner. Somebody that's prone to talking and doing things she shouldn't. Mama Rebecca. She hears Isaac talking. And as soon as Isaac's out of the way, she goes and runs to her favorite child, Jacob, who is supposed to get this blessing. And we have the big falsehood as a result. The big falsehood, the big fraud moment, the deception. It started by Rebecca. She says to him, go and pretend that you're your brother and go in there and give him a feast and I'll help you fix it. And Jacob says, I can't do that. He'll know I'm different. What if he comes near? He says, come here, and he feels my arms. We know that Esau's arms are hairy. And mine are, well, smooth skin, and he's going to be able to tell the difference. So they fix some special, what do you call those sleeves? You know those sleeves that the basketball players today wear? That's not new. They were doing it way back there. Jacob learned how to do that. He put on a sleeve there that had hair on it. And so when his dad called him forward, he says, you sound like Jacob, but, and he put on Esau's clothes. He says, you smell like Esau. Can you tell the difference between your children's smell, by the way? you know your children pretty well. You smell like Esau. I don't know if that was a compliment or not. Maybe Esau didn't usually smell very good, but he said, well, it's the smell of the earth, the outdoors. He loves that. Maybe Jacob always smelled like good cooking. I don't know what he smelled like. But at any rate, he puts on Jacob's smell and he puts on Jacob's clothes and he tries to talk like Jacob and he deceives his dad. His dad even suspects he's lying. But finally, Jacob convinces him and he eats of the field of the food and he gives the blessing, the inheritance in a ceremony to Jacob. Jacob barely gets out of the chamber there when Esau comes back and he's brought in this big feast. He's prepared it. He brings him in. He says, Dad, here I am. Here's the feast. And Isaac says, who is this? He says, it's Esau, your firstborn. And Isaac says, who was that just came in here and took all the blessing that I was supposed to give to you? And then he says, yes, I gave it to him and he will keep it. I think in that moment, Isaac realized he was wrong in the first place to ever try to give it to Esau because God said that Jacob was going to be the one. And so he receives that. But Esau at that time is distraught. He says, can I have something? Can't you give me anything? And he cries, it says, with great tears. He was angry and bitter. And from that moment on, he said, I'm going to kill my brother. He got the blessing, but I'll get it my way. I'll kill him, and everything that comes from him goes to me. He was angry. That's what people do when they get angry. They want to get even. It's the devil-inspired hatred for whom God blesses. It's the same rage and jealousy of Cain who killed his brother. If you don't have the Lord in your life, you're going to have hatred and anger for others. Which leads then to the broken family. That moment, that great event was a broken family. From that moment on, these brothers never, ever felt the same toward each other. And Jacob and Esau fought. Rebekah and Isaac, perhaps there was trouble there too. Why did you do this to me? A broken family. Some of you have had to deal with broken families as well. And so that brings us to the end of Isaac. Let's go on to Jacob now because the story keeps going on. And we want to look at Jacob in three ways too. Jacob, first of all, in leaving the promised land. And he left the promised land. He gets a charge by dad in chapter 28, verses 1 through 5. His dad tells him, you got the blessing there in verse 3. And God Almighty bless thee and make thee fruitful and multiply thee. And thou mayest be multiplied with it. And he gives the blessing of Abraham in verse 4 to thee and to thy seed with thee that thou mayest inherit the land. The land, the land. You might circle the word the land as you work your way through Genesis. It's prominent over and over again. And we can see that once again, here's one of those key pillars and that's coming off the whole pillar, the Abrahamic covenant that's holding this tent up. Here's another key line. It came to Abraham. It came to Isaac, his son, and now it's coming to Jacob. All the way around, we'll see it continuing to come to all of these individuals that come from Abraham's loins. The charge by dad. There's a contrast in decision there. Esau goes and gets another wife. He thinks, well, maybe I can please mom and dad if I get another wife that's from the family, kind of like it's from Ishmael. That's from Abraham's other son. So he's hoping to get some blessing from that. But then there's this covenant dream in verses 10 through 12. Esau had threatened at Jacob, and Jacob is running for his life. He's leaving the land. And on his way out, he stops at nighttime before he gets out of the land in a place that we know today as Bethel. And so this covenant dream, there's a description reported, verses 10 through 12. And Jacob went out from Beersheba and went toward Haran, and he came to a certain place and tarried there all night. Because the sun was set, he took up the stones of that place and put them for pillows and lay down in a place to sleep. Anybody ever use a stone for pillow here? That just cracks me up when I read that. I thought, how in the world does he do that? I'm sure there's got to be some kind of downy on top of that. I don't know. But pillows, stones for a pillow. In verse 12, it says, and he dreamed, and behold, a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven, and behold, the angels of God descending and descending. So he's dreaming, and he sees this ladder that goes from the promised land all the way up to heaven, and angels are coming down and back and forth on that ladder. It's a picture, by the way, of probably what is very real. When God sits on his throne in heaven and gives instructions to his angels, they quickly come down from heaven to earth, wherever he's got something for them to do, and they do it, and then they go back up to heaven. And there's probably angels coming and going all the time. We can't see them, but I think they're there. And especially in this location, it's like he's got a direct route from the promised land right into the gates of heaven. Then there's divine revelation given in verses 13 to 15. Verse 13 says, and behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham, thy father, and the God of Isaac. Here it is. The land wherein thou liest to thee will I give it and to thy seed. And thy seed shall be as the dust of the earth, and thou shalt spread it abroad to the west, the east, the north, the south, and to thee. And in thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And behold, he says, verse 15, I am with thee and will keep thee in all places to which thou goest, and will bring thee again into this land. I'm going to bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done that which I have spoken of to thee. What a promise. All about the land, the seed, and the blessing. There it is again. The same key covenant. Special emphasis here on the land. Why? Because Jacob is leaving the land. And God wanted Jacob to know, this covenant that I have with you is connected not only with your seed and your blessing, but with the land that I'm going to give you. He says, I'm going to keep you, but I'm going to bring you back here. There's a documented response here in verse 16 to 22. Jacob senses God's presence. He renames the place Bethel, the house of God. He sets up a special landmark pillar there so he can recognize it when he comes back. And he pours oil over it and makes a vow to God before leaving. The vow that he makes, he says, if God keeps me safe and brings me back to this land, he will be my God forever. It's almost like a conditional prayer. Lord, I want you to save me if. Well, we'll see what happens. Secondly, we come to Jacob when he's away from the promised land. We've seen Jacob leaving the promised land. Now we're going to see Jacob away from the promised land. We're going to move quickly through here. There's collaboration, verse 20, chapter 29, verse 1. He goes and he finds his uncle Laban. He runs into this beautiful young daughter of hers, and he falls in love with her. Everything seems to be hunky-dory at the beginning. He's going to get a wife. He's got a job. Laban seems to be pretty excited. He got a new, pretty handsome, talented, strong ranch hand to join his staff there. Uncle Laban's pretty happy. Jacob's happy. He's got a safe place to live. And he's getting his eyes on that young lady. He says, can I have her? And he said, they make a deal. Yep, you can have her. 7 years. That's a deal. I only had to pay 5 years for Debbie. I'm telling you what, I don't know how I got such a good deal, but it was a great one. 7 years, and then what happens? We've got this, he's caught. He gets caught in this jaws of deception by his uncle. Apparently Jacob learns he's not the only one that knows how to deceive, and God is bringing this back, this deception thing, back to bite him. And instead of getting Rachel, the one he wanted, he gets, I guess they thought she was ugly, Leah. And he gets Leah. Now, I'm sure that Leah was okay, but Jacob wasn't in love with Leah. He wanted Rachel. So he esteemed at his uncle. What are you doing to me? Oh, and he's got a pretty cute little response there, but deception is the issue. God is dealing with Jacob in the same issue he had. What goes around what, folks? Comes around, and he was a deceiver, and God is going to bring the same thing to him. And he does. Well, he gets Rachel anyways. They make a deal and it's okay. Everything goes on. Everything's be hunky-dory again. But there's children now coming along. A lot of children here in the next few chapters here. In fact, he gets 12 sons and one daughter. Then there's conflict in chapter 30. This whole seems to fly by the scene seems to fly by quickly, but there are years briefly summarized here. Jacob is dealing with disgruntled wives and a cheating, dishonest employer. He is working very hard, trying to make an honest living, but he is constantly facing trouble with his uncle boss. His boss changes his wages continually. He changes his job description. He takes away his benefits. He generally is making life difficult for Jacob. That's when we get the call. God comes to him in chapter 31 and says, "All right, Jacob, let's go back to the land. Go back to the land. This is not where I want you to hang out for any longer. Return to the covenant land." Now we see why God allows Uncle Laban to mistreat his servant. He wants to make life uncomfortable enough for Jacob so that he's willing to go back and face his brother in the fear of his brother's wrath. But it got so miserable there, and enough time had passed, he said, "Well, maybe he's cooled down enough. Maybe I can go back home now." And so he decides to go back, but there, that leads to a controversy, one last controversy with his uncle Laban. He is a deceptive flight. Jacob picks up all his belongings, his family, and sneaks out of town quietly. He is still struggling with honesty issues. We all need to learn, like Jacob, to be open and honest in all of our lives. His uncle seems to be so angry at him that he's going to start a big fight. He might have even been willing to kill his nephew until the fact that God came to him that night and says, "Don't you lay a finger on him. Be careful. Don't you offer him another new deal to bring him back. Don't say anything good or bad to him. Just be careful." And so Jacob comes back, which leads us to the final part, Jacob's returning to the promised land. Chapter 32 through 36. First of all, there's revelation. As he gets close, he runs into an interesting event, and he has this wrestling encounter with God. Notice verse 1 of chapter 32, "And Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him." Remember those angels that were climbing up and down on that ladder? They were still in the land, and now Jacob comes back to the land, and guess what? The angels are there, and they come to meet him, to welcome him back, and let him know that they're protecting him. Later on, Jacob indeed wrestles with an angel. So we see that God gives him some divine confirmation here. And there's divine promises throughout here. I'm not going to spend time on this. I'm just going to go quickly. But he sends some messengers to Esau. And Esau, the only answer he gets is, "Esau's coming back to meet you. And he's bringing 400 men with him." Well, that sounds like an army to me. And Jacob is just scared spitless. "My brother is still angry. He's going to kill me. He's going to kill me." Which leads to a very desperate prayer at this time. Look at his prayer in verse 9. Genesis 32, 9. "And Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, the Lord who said to me, return unto thy country and thy kindred, and I will deal well with thee." Verse 11, he says, "Deliver me, I pray thee, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he will come and smite me and the mother with the children. And you said, I will surely do thee good and make thy seed as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude." God, you promised you'd protect me if I came back to the land, and now my brother's coming to kill me. Protect me, I pray. This is his foxhole conversion, if you please. He is under fire. He's expecting his brother to come and kill him. He is scared death, and he cries out with all of his heart, and he wrestles with God. The last part of this is one of the most powerful texts in the Old Testament. It's very mystical. And I could spend an hour talking to you about it, but let's move on. God changes his name at that point. In chapter 33, we find reconciliation. Esau does come, and there's a happy conclusion. The anger seems to be gone. The hatchet is buried, although we think. But then we find out later on in the Bible, in the Old Testament, that it isn't completely buried. Chapter 34, we have this rampage. They come in and they settle in the land. And there's a tragic thing that happens. Their daughter, Dinah, is violated by a man from the town of Shechem. And the brothers get so angry, they go and they kill the whole city. They destroy the city. A little bit too extreme, I would say. They should have killed just the guy that violated her. But they take out the whole city. It's a rampage. Then we come to chapter 35, and there's a revival, though. God, how does this revival happen? It starts with a commencement call. It commences with a call. God says, come, go back to the place where you built that altar. Come back to the place where I promised you. Remember, we made a deal, and you said, if I brought you back safely, that you would make me your God. And so this revival is coming back to the beginning and remembering. And so he comes back to Bethel, is what it says in verse 1. And then there's a commitment to this whole thing, a conduct. How are we going to act? If you want revival, it's a commitment to your conduct, what you're doing with God. And Jacob goes back there and he says, put your foreign gods away. People had idols in his family. His own wives had idols. Put them away. They get rid of their jewelry, everything about them, and they bury them. And they come back in verse 7. He builds an altar and he worships God. That is how revival begins. It's when you get reconciled and you make your conduct as such that is pleasing to God. Then it leads to this covenant connection. Notice verse 9, and God appeared unto Jacob, verse 9, and when he came out of Paddan Aram and blessed him, and God said unto him, thy name is Jacob. Thy name shall not be called anymore Jacob, but Israel shall thy name be. And he called his name Israel. And God said unto him, here's the covenant promise again, verse 11, I am God Almighty, be fruitful and multiply, a nation and a company of nations shall be of thee, and kings shall come out of thy loins. And here it is, folks, the land which I gave Abraham and Isaac, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed after thee, I give the land. And God went up from him in the place where he talked with him. And Jacob set up a pillar there, and he bore for drink, and he worshiped there. That place is called Bethel, the house of God. It became a very special place to the nation of Israel from that point on. Revival leads often sometimes to crushing challenges as well. The devil sees that you're walking with God and getting your path on right with God, and then he comes after you with everything he can. Notice the terrible, crushing challenges that faced Jacob at this point. In verse 8, it says Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died. So she died. And then later on in verse 19, it says, and Rachel died and was buried in the way of Ephrathah, which is Bethlehem. So two deaths there. And then his own son goes up and commits fornication, adultery with one of his wives. I'm telling you what, that is just terrible, the kind of crushing challenges that he faces here. And then finally, Jacob's father dies. In verse 27, Jacob came unto Isaac, his father. Verse 28, and the days of Isaac were 104 years, and Isaac died. Here it is again, and was gathered unto his people, being old and full of days. So here he dies, and he's gathered to his people. Notice that last phrase there. It's interesting. At verse 29, it says, and the sons and his sons, Esau and Jacob, buried him. Jacob and Esau came together. There was enough of a reunion and a coming together that they buried their dad together. So finally, we conclude with the records of chapter 36. In chapter 36, we have a long list of names, and I'm going to read every one of them. No, I'm not going to. But I want to draw your attention to a couple things here. First of all, there's separation. We see that these are the generations of Esau, okay? And Esau goes and moves away. So there's a separation of these two boys and their land where they live, and Esau moved down into what is called Edom. In the last verse of this chapter 36 tells us that the chief of Aram, these are the chiefs of Edom according to their habitations in the land of their possession. He is Esau, the father of the Edomites. So we know that he was the father of that nation. So then it gives a list of his sons, verses 9 through the end of the chapter. And there are two sons I'd like you to see here, two names I want to draw your attention to. One is found in verse 10. It says, these are the names of Esau's sons. What's the first one? Eliphaz. Eliphaz, the son of Ada. Verse 11, and the sons of Eliphaz were, and then verse 12, and Timna was concubine to Eliphaz. His name is mentioned there. Some of you recall that name and you've heard it before. We find it in the book of Job. Eliphaz was one of the three friends, or frenemies we might say, that came to comfort Job. And then there's one other name I want you to see here. It's in verse 28. In verse 28 it says, and the children of Dishan are these, Uz and Aran. Uz became a well-known name, and the book of Job starts out, there was a man of the land of Uz. So Job was most likely one of the sons or grandsons or in this family of Esau, and he lived down in that area. He was a very rich sheik in those days, and Eliphaz was one of the sons of Esau that perhaps came to comfort him. Now, we don't know for sure, but most likely that's what it comes. What we learn is that the book of Job and the events of that took place during the days of Jacob and Esau, perhaps, or after that in Joseph, days of Joseph, before Moses. So that's why many people think that Job is an older book than the books of Genesis through Deuteronomy, because Moses is the author of those. Probably it was written before, but it talks to us about things that happened in the days of Jacob and Esau. Finally, there is the significance. The significance. Why put all these names in chapter 36? Well, it documents the fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham, I will multiply thy seed. God surely multiplied that. And he will make thee a father of many nations. God is fulfilling his promises. But secondly, it helps us to understand that God keeps records of all. And he has a special plan for each group. He knows who belongs to who, and he wants us to see the difference. God keeps track of every human being that's ever born. He knows what family you came from. And he knows where you're headed and where you're going and what the future's going to be. And we see the future of Esau because he turned away from God. His future and his family after him did not follow God. It became a sad storyline. But now we're going to turn back to Jacob, and we'll turn to that tonight as we look in particular in the life of Joseph, his son. So let's conclude with some application this morning. There are so many things we can come from here. I just chose three things. First of all, beware of the Isaac disease. I call the Isaac disease parental favoritism. He had it, so did his wife. Be careful of that, parents and even grandparents, perhaps. Be careful of choosing favorites and treating them different. Kids notice. They pay attention. And they will tell you, my father didn't like me. My mother didn't like me. They like my sister. They like my brother. And it creates inside a jealousy and an anger and a bitterness. Beware of the Isaac disease. Secondly, beware of the Jacob disease. Jacob had the disease we call deception. He picked it up from his grandfather Abraham and is from his father Isaac. They were deceptive in some things, and so Jacob learned how to be deceptive. He learned how to lie so skillfully. And how many times is lying an issue in our lives? Beware of the Jacob disease. Proverbs 12:19 is a great verse for us to remember today. The lip of truth shall be established forever, but a lying tongue is but for a moment. You tell a lie in a moment of when you think it's going to help you get out of a tight pinch, and it only lasts for that brief moment, and then eventually the truth comes out. But if you tell the truth from the beginning, it is never forgotten. He wouldn't lie to save his soul. He would always tell the truth. That's the way God is. Beware of the Jacob disease of deception. Finally, beware of the Esau disease. Beware of the Esau disease. What is his disease? It's the love of this world. He didn't love the covenant. He didn't love the inheritance that was connected to the God of his fathers. The love of this world leads to careless focus on God and careless focus on spiritual matters. He didn't care about the covenant with God. He only wanted the inheritance. The Bible warns us over and over again. John's words are perhaps the clearest there. 1 John chapter 2, and verse 15. Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. For whoever loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. You can't love God and love this world at the same time. For all that is in the world, he says, is the lust of the eyes and the lust of the flesh and the pride of life. And it kills. Beware of the Esau disease. Make sure that you have a heart that is in tune and loving God primarily above anything else. My little children, John said, keep your heart from idols. Keep yourselves from idols. I think that is perhaps the biggest business of the enemy today. He works overtime to get all of us to love, fall in love with idols in this world. He makes something look so great. God help us to beware of the Esau disease.